her passion for Alaska is really what I was struck by. And I think that's really key.
Governor Bill Walker announces the new Attorney General. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a bleak oil forecast from the Energy Information Administration.
Unless more oil is found in Alaska, it's very possible the Alaska pipeline itself would end up shutting down.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Resource Basket is a training and technical assistance center helping rural communities support healthy, resilient, and culturally connected youth. Tribes and youth-serving organizations can request support, explore resources, and find opportunities at resourcebasket.org or call the team directly at 1-800-478-7227, extension 7396. This message sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program.
Governor Bill Walker announced today that Jana Lindemuth will be Alaska's next Attorney General. She replaces Craig Richards, who resigned abruptly last week. The change is part of a major overhaul of Walker's leadership team. More than a quarter of Walker's cabinet has turned over in a little more than 2 months. Andrew Kitchenman of APRN and KTOO covered the announcement. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Lori.
So what did Governor Walker say about why he picked Lindemuth?
The governor cites two things in particular. Lindemuth's commitment to the state as a lifelong Alaskan and as someone who's done pro bono work with the law firm Dorsey & Whitney on cases like the Fairbanks Four. That was the case of three Alaska Native men and a fourth man who were convicted in a 1997 murder and were released last year after a judge vacated their convictions.
Her passion for Alaska is really what I was struck by. And I think that's really key. And I see that in my cabinet members, that they do have a passion for Alaska. And that's absolutely critical to accomplish our mission.
What did Lindemuth have to say about the Fairbanks Four case?
She says it's the most meaningful legal work she's done in her life. She also says she's committed to justice for all Alaskans. And it's important to keep in mind that there are real people affected by every legal decision.
I really am truly honored to be a part of that case. I truly believe in the innocence of those four men, and I'm really happy that they're out of prison now and enjoying life like the rest of us.
Andrew, what do we know about Jana Lindemuth's priorities?
Lori, she stayed away from saying what her priorities would be as Attorney General. She says it's too soon. Walker only contacted her about the job late last week after Richards resigned.
Well, what else did the governor talk about in his press avail today?
He introduced three other cabinet members who he'd previously announced: Natural Resources Commissioner Andy Mack, Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan, and Education Commissioner Michael Johnson. Mack comes from the private equity firm PT Capital, and Monaghan is a former public safety commissioner, and was most recently the acting corrections commissioner. And Johnson served as Copper River School District's superintendent in Glen Allen. Mack says the state should be paying offense in making plans for projects like the proposed natural gas pipeline.
All right. Thank you, Andrew, for that update.
Thanks, Lori.
That was APRN and KTOO state government reporter Andrew Kitchenman. The Energy Information Administration has little good news for Alaska's oil sector. The federal agency released its annual energy outlook today. It shows oil production from Alaska dwindling to less than half its current level after 2030. EIA Administrator Adam Siminski explains.
Unless more oil is found in Alaska or along the pipeline right away, it's very possible that the Alaska pipeline itself, which delivers oil from the northern part of the state to Valdez, would end up shutting down.
That's the baseline case. If the EIA assumes advances in technology and more discovery, the forecast for Alaska production would bump along at about the current level and then rise a bit by 2040, the end of the forecast period. The rosy scenario assumes oil production from federal waters starting in 2035. As for prices, Siminski wasn't very specific, even over the short term.
If you use the current options prices over the next year or so, what that says is oil prices could be anywhere between about $25 a barrel and $80 a barrel.
In the EIA baseline forecast, oil would fetch $100 a barrel by the late 2020s. But don't bank on it. Siminski warns that volatility is too high to forecast what the price will be with much certainty. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a search is underway near Nome for a man missing since the weekend.
We're looking for a needle in a haystack because he didn't give direction to where he was going.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Search and rescue efforts continue today for a hiker that went missing in the Nome area over the weekend. According to Alaska State Troopers, 36-year-old Joseph Balderas was reported missing Monday morning after not showing up for work. An initial search on Monday led troopers to Balderas' vehicle at mile 44 on the Nome Council Highway, but they found no sign of him. Megan Peters with Alaska State Troopers says the search and rescue effort is largely being led by local volunteers.
The Nome Volunteer Fire Department and SAR has deployed multiple ATVs to do a ground search of the area. And we've also established remote communications in the field so everyone can talk.
And Peters says the search isn't just limited to the ground. The state troopers chartered a small helicopter with two volunteer spotters. Wildlife troopers have their own helicopter in the air, and the U.S. Coast Guard sent a Jayhawk helicopter stationed in Kotzebue to help as well.
Total number of personnel out on the search right now is close to 60.
Jim West Jr. is the chief of the Nome Volunteer Fire Department. He says one of those personnel helping from a helicopter did spot an article of clothing, but confirmed it did not belong to Balderas. Despite all hands on deck, West says the thick willows and soft tundra make the search especially difficult this time of year.
We're looking for a needle in a haystack because he didn't give direction to where he was going.
Much of Nome is closed for the day, including the Nome Community Center, the XYZ Senior Center, the Food Bank, and the Boys and Girls Club, as members of the community assist in the search. For the first time ever, hunters who live outside the Northwest Arctic will not be allowed to hunt caribou on federal lands. The Federal Subsistence Board has closed Game Management Unit 23 starting July 1st. In an effort to conserve Alaska's largest herd and protect subsistence. But the year-long ban has created some controversy and confusion surrounding the hunt. Just last week, the state of Alaska petitioned U.S. Secretary of the Interior Sally Jewell to intervene in the decision. KNOM's Laura Craigle reports.
It's breakfast. Victor Carman is having biscuits and gravy at one of his favorite spots in Kotzebue. With fall fast approaching, though, he says he's been thinking a lot lately about another favorite food.
Caribou, one of the most used animals of the region, been controversial ever since I got back.
Carmen's originally from the village of Deering, but he's lived in Kotzebue since 1979. That's when he returned to Alaska after serving in the military, and that's also when he started noticing that the region was a little busier when he boated up the Noatak River each season to hunt caribou.
All of a sudden, the transporters, outfitters, found out about this region, and we've been really locking horns with them for about 20 years or better.
Some locals say outside hunters are disrespectful, wasting meat or leaving trash at their camps. Others claim that outsiders have an unfair advantage because they can afford to fly and land near the herd, while local families have to pool their money for boat fuel and wait for caribou to cross the rivers. No matter who you talk to, though, Carmen says one thing is clear. It's gotten harder for people to fill their freezers each fall. The Northwest Arctic caribou herd has shrunk by half in the last 10 or 15 years, and the animals have stopped following many of their traditional migratory routes. Outside hunters may not be to blame, but Carmen says taking them out of the equation for a year is certainly worth a try.
Right now, we got a little breathing room. Maybe the village of Noatak will get a little reprieve and maybe get some animals this fall. Who knows?
That attitude is frustrating, though, for outside hunters and the bush pilots and guides who rely on their business.
It's absurd, really.
Jared Cummings owns Golden Eagle Outfitters, a transporter service that's operated out of Kotzebue for nearly 10 years. Since the closure was announced in April, he says the company has lost around $250,000, refunding money to caribou clients who had booked trips this season. That's a big chunk of business, but Cummings says it's not really about the money.
It's about what's right or wrong. These people are United States citizens. They want to come up here and shoot one caribou. They should be allowed to.
Cummings points to population estimates from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The state hasn't finished a full caribou survey since 2013, but officials say a recent rough estimate puts the herd at 206,000 animals. That number would indicate the herd is stabilizing after years of decline. And if that's true, Cummings says the word conservation may be masking the real motive behind the closure.
It's not biological at all, and I think everybody knows what that means.
Namely, prejudice against outside hunters, which some say is unfounded. According to guides and transporters, outside hunters don't waste meat or mess up migration routes by flying in. Instead, they argue that outside hunters donate extra meat to elders, and that caribou are changing their own patterns in response to a changing climate. So, for many of those who do work with outsiders, it really boils down to one thing.
They resent people coming in with new Cabela's camo off.
Jake Jacobson has been a hunting guide since the 70s. He splits his time between Kodiak and a camp north of Kotzebue.
They just resent outsiders coming in that way, and I can't understand that. That's territorialism, and I think that's part of human nature. But that's just something that if we live in a civil society, we have to accept.
Jacobson says his business will take a big financial hit this season. He's lost six clients who won't make the trip if they can't hunt caribou. But he says his main concern is that the closure will set a dangerous precedent for future restrictions.
This is an unnecessary infringement of public access to public resource on public land.
The problem with that thinking, though, is that the resource has a very different significance for local hunters than it does for outsiders. At least, that's how Pete Schaefer sees it.
Caribou is still the mainstay of our diet, so it's pretty much a no-brainer. I mean, we have to be able to gather the animal and use it.
Schaefer's from Kotzebue, and he's hunted caribou since he was a teenager, primarily on the Kobuk and Selawik Rivers. Unlike outside hunters, he says most local families do not have an easy grocery alternative if their hunts don't pan out.
When you go to a village where a bag of pre-cooked chicken is upwards of $20, then you go to Anchorage, it's $4.99, and you can better understand what I'm talking about.
So as caribou have gotten harder to hunt, regardless of the reasons or how the herd may rebound, Schaefer says the closure makes sense right now. He says hopefully it'll take some pressure off local hunters and give them a better chance at gathering the major staple of their diet.
To them, it's a recreational need. In some cases, they use the meat, but inadvertently raises the question as to whether people that hunt for sport have just as much right as people that have a critical need for the meat.
Back at breakfast, Victor Carmen says someday he thinks locals and outsiders could coexist.
And if it was managed correctly, there's enough animals to go around. I don't know if that's ever going to happen.
And until Fish and Game surveys the whole herd again, no one's really sure that there are enough caribou. If the survey attempt this fall is successful, there'll be a brand new population estimate by December, something that could reinforce the need for closures and conservation or bring the complicated conversation right back to where it started. Reporting in Kotzebue, I'm Laura Craigle.
Heavy rain is forecast for the Alaska Range. National Weather Service meteorologist Scott Berg says two systems coming together over the state are expected to dump significant moisture on the mountains.
We have a low pressure system sitting out in the Gulf of Alaska that's going to kind of move north. And we have high pressure building in the interior. And what's going to happen is we'll have a convergent area right over the Alaska Range develop. And with that, a lot of moisture is going to be pumped in from the south to to the Alaska Range, and so that's going to develop into some heavy rains through the Alaska Range for the rest of the week.
Berg says areas to the north of the mountain should largely be shadowed from heavy precipitation.
Most of the interior should stay out of the rain. We do expect some showers along the north slopes of the Alaska Range, but most likely not as far north as Fairbanks.
Berg notes that Fairbanks is nearing a monthly rainfall record. 3.21 inches of rain has fallen so far this month. What's in a name? For some, it's just a name. For others, it represents generations of family history. Cordelia Kignock Kelly started using her Inupiaq name at work a few years ago for practical reasons. In this second installment of a five-part series, Kelly talks about what her native name tells people about her.
My name is Cordelia. Inupiaq. I am Inupiaq. I use my Inupiaq name for some very practical reasons. I was emailing back and forth with a cousin of mine a few years ago and for work, and she was working at the North Slope Borough at the time, and I was emailing as Cordelia and signing my name as Cordelia, and then finally I actually inserted my Inupiaq name. I said, "All right, see you later, Kilnock." And she replied, "Oh, it is you! Oh, I thought it might be you." She didn't know me as Cordelia. She didn't know she was emailing with her cousin. And it was only until I said Kilna that she knew who she was speaking with. And I thought to myself, there's probably a lot of other people that might know me as Kilna first and then Cordelia second. And so I switched it on Facebook, or I added Kilna so that if I'm friending somebody, they know who I am. If I say Cordelia Kelly, that doesn't mean anything. It unlocks nothing about me, like saying Kilnock can, because when I use the name Kilnock, it immediately associates me with the person that I was named after, you know, Felton Sullivan, and who he was and who my family is. When you hear Kilnock, you're going to know that I'm named after somebody from Wainwright, and so I have a connection to Wainwright, which is where my family's from. You know, if you say Kilnock, it's going to shed light on the fact that I'm Inupiaq and I come from, you know, a northern region, and it's going to, you know, shed light on my relationships and my family connections to the 150 people that are closest to me in a way that Cordelia is just not going to do.
That was the second installment of a five-part series on Alaska Native names produced by KTOO's Jennifer Canfield. A link to the full interview is at our website, alaskapublic.org.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University provides working professionals an educational pathway to career advancement. Through APU's hybrid course format of online and campus-based courses, students can focus on healthcare, finance, technology, and strategic leadership options. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The city of Anchorage is getting a new pool of money to address homelessness. The mayor's office announced today a $1.3 million grant from the U.S. Departments of Justice and Housing and Urban Development. The money will fund research into how to overhaul city services for residents of Anchorage and the Mat-Su Valley dealing with chronic homelessness and frequent problems with the criminal justice system. Nancy Burke is the city's homeless coordinator. She says municipal leaders will study how to implement what's called a pay-for-success model.
Basically, in really easy terms, it's borrowing money to make a change in a system while you still have the other existing commitments out there. So you're borrowing money to do the new thing to prove it up while you're still doing the old thing.
The old thing, in this case, is the city's current model for providing services to people living on the streets. That, Burke says, involves costs to hospitals, the state, and taxpayers with inadequate results. The new thing is a switch to a housing-first model, which prioritizes getting people into stable long-term shelter and providing wrap-around services.
If we can house people and show that it reduces those investments, then there will be a savings at the end of the day.
The money itself will go to consultants working on a plan for phased implementation and financing. The goal is to ultimately figure out a way to issue a bond to pay for the changeover, which Burke describes as an investment.
It's a way of looking at using and leveraging finances for social service outcomes rather than, you know, business outcomes that you would usually see.
Burke says she hopes the fully structured plan will be ready within 2 years. For all its prevalence in Alaskan communities, drug addiction can be a difficult healthcare problem to manage. Proper treatment depends on timing and access to services, which aren't always available in small-town Alaska. Limited options mean it can be hard to beat addiction at home, forcing some people to leave all they know to find the help they need. In part one of a two-part series, KCAW's Brielle Schaefer explores the challenges of finding treatment for drug addiction in rural Alaska and the consequences for those who can't get help.
33-year-old Lael Grant was last seen in a Sitka grocery store in the early morning of October 15, 2012. Despite an intensive search, she has never been found. She was using meth at the time of her disappearance. Erica Burkhaus is Grant's sister. When her mom called her in October of 2011, she knew there was a serious problem. Burkhaus flew from her home in Juneau to Sitka for a family intervention.
She was so thin. I mean, she just was incredibly, incredibly thin, and she looked absolutely awful. And it was that point where I just started crying. I mean, I took one look at her and I just burst into tears. And that's when I talked to her about her addiction and her youth. And I mean, I told her, I said, we need to get you help. You're going to end up dead. I mean, just literally, that's what I said. You are going to end up dead.
The two sisters sat together in her trailer and talked for a couple hours. Grant was at first angry. Then she admitted she needed help, but they couldn't coordinate a medical detox in Sitka. Burkhaus considers this moment a crossroads.
The window of opportunity leaves quickly. So you have somebody that's addicted and they admit that they have a problem. And right then at that point in time, you have to get them the help that they need. So we lost the opportunity, which is unfortunate. And then it was about a year later that she went missing.
The right kind of treatment can be effective, but more often than not, people need to leave home to get it.
Hi. You all right? This is Leonora.
I'm Leonora, Brielle. This is Brielle.
I met up with Jennifer Blankenship Douglas and Leonora Barton at the Betty Davis Adult Reentry Center in Anchorage.
We grew up together in Sitka years ago.
Both women got hooked on drugs in Sitka. They started at a young age, huffing paint or smoking weed, drinking alcohol, partying in the woods. It escalated from there. Their drug addictions caused them to lose custody of their children. And they both had to leave Southeast to get the treatment they needed.
You have to leave everything and everyone you know and go someplace far away like I did. You know, I was living in Ketchikan and had to come all the way to Anchorage to get treatment. Any person who knows and truly wants recovery knows that 30 days is not enough at all. For me, it took me 20-something years to create my problem and to sit in it. It's going to take more than 30 days for me to get over it.
Blankenship Douglas says she was sexually abused when she was younger and used meth as a form of therapy.
It got to the point where I couldn't handle emotions. I couldn't handle my feelings. And somebody said, hey, here, try this. And it worked. I didn't sleep. Because I didn't sleep, I didn't dream. Because I didn't dream, I didn't have night terrors that woke me up screaming in the middle of the night.
She's been in and out of jail often since then. After an arrest last year on felony charges for possession with intent to sell meth, she could opt for treatment instead of jail. But after a month waiting for a treatment bed to open up, she went to talk to a counselor at the Ketchikan Indian Community, which has an outpatient substance abuse program.
She's like, well, what are your plans? And I said, my plans are I'm going to use. And she's like, what? I thought you wanted to go to treatment. I said, I do.
I don't want to use, but that's what my plans are looking like real quick.
Blankenship Douglas got a lucky break. She was able to get one of the 42 beds at the Salvation Army Clitheroe Center, finished the treatment program, and then transferred to the Betty Davis Reentry Center, a halfway house. And that's where her story and Barton's intersect again.
Having a friend like Jennifer is amazing. She's just, I couldn't have done it without her.
Barton had been posting on Facebook about her struggles with a meth addiction and subsequent homelessness. She'd been in and out of rehab 9 times already. But this time, Barton said she was ready to get clean. Blankenship Douglas reached out and got her to come to the halfway house. But before Barton moved in, she wanted to sober up. She says a family friend and Metla Katla gave her money to rent a hotel for a week to detox. When she started living at the center, she was 9 days clean.
2 or 3 days after I moved in here, they found a lady like frozen to a bench here in Anchorage, and that could have been me, because that's the way I was living.
The two go to Narcotics and Alcoholics Anonymous meetings almost daily.
God, I offer myself to thee to build with me.
Some meetings you hear what you need, some meetings you don't. That's the beauty, and keep coming back. Because if you don't hear what you need today, you might tomorrow. And if you don't tomorrow, then you might the next day.
Blankenship Douglas has been sober now for 14 months, the longest ever in her adult life, and has moved out of the halfway house.
Every day that I'm given clean and sober is another blessing. I really believe that if I would have stayed in Sitka, it wouldn't have happened.
Barton has to wait on assessments from the state before she can be placed in a treatment program in Anchorage. This process can leave Alaskans waiting for weeks, even months. Addiction is a small community in rural Alaska. Blankenship Douglas and Barton knew Grant. They grew up with her. They did drugs with her. And their stories could have had similar endings. But they didn't, because they were able to get help.
If I can honor her memory in any way, it's by me staying clean.
They both feel like they owe that to her in their recoveries. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Brielle Schaefer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Jennifer Canfield in Juneau, Graylin Brashear and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Emily Russell and Laura Craigle in Nome, and Brielle Schaefer in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Resource Basket is a training and technical assistance center helping rural communities support healthy, resilient, and culturally connected youth. Tribes and youth-serving organizations can request support, explore resources, and find opportunities at resourcebasket.org or call the team directly at 1-800-478-7227, extension 7396. This message sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program. The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.